Singer Manus, and thank you, Gus, for the title. We've created a world here, haven't we? I've just been very, very struck over the days. It feels actually like months that we've been here. I've been very, very struck that there is a complete world here, a complete world, a world created by our practice together, our working together, our living together, by the shrine, by the talks, by our reflections, by our journeys individually, supporting each other collectively to create a whole world. And it feels to me like this is a human world, a thoroughly good human world, what human beings everywhere should be able to experience. It's not about Buddhism, it's about being human, and this is the world that we've created. Every human being should be able to look at another human being and have some sort of sense of recognition, of being able to be themselves, be heard, be empathized with. That feels to me just an ordinary human quality. Unfortunately, it's rare. Unfortunately, it's rare. And personally, I just feel very, very pleased and satisfied. That feels too weak a word. Just really, really happy that you've brought this world into being. I feel it's a privilege to be on the team when there's a retreat like this happening. The team work very, very hard. I've been very aware of that. They work really, really hard. But we couldn't make a retreat happen. And I just feel very, very pleased with how all of you, all of us, have engaged so courageously and fully with the creation of this world. It has to be a collective endeavor, do you see? It has to be collective. Otherwise, it's not a world. Otherwise, it's a solitary experience. And no matter how wonderful a solitary experience is, it's not a world. But I'm also aware that there's a world out there, a much, much bigger world out there, that isn't on retreat at the moment. And there has to be some sort of relationship between our world here, what we've done, what we're creating, what we're still doing, and the larger world out there. Otherwise, it's a bubble that we've been living in. Do you see what I mean? And no matter how beautiful and magical and iridescent that bubble, that's not enough. I wouldn't be a Buddhist if that was what Buddhism was about. The world out there is really in need. I had a little foray into the world yesterday with Ollie. We had a little adventure. We needed some, we needed candles and flowers, and Ollie and I volunteered to go out into the world. We did feel like slightly intrepid adventurers, sort of stepping we got into the car, Ollie offered to drive. We were, you know, being navigated by satellite technology, heading for this place that they call Ledbury. looking for precious things that we can offer to the Buddha. And the people of Ledbury were friendly. They were, weren't they? They were very, very friendly. And after some searching, there was a quest, actually. The first florist was closed. The second florist that we were directed to was sort of closed, although she opened the door to tell us that she was closed. And all the lilies were for her wedding. So we wished her a successful wedding. And then, well, flowers, the candles were easy, but the flowers were not so easy to come by. The co-op eventually came good. There's a whole world, isn't there? There's a world out there. But I was travelling, it felt like Ollie and I took something of the retreat with us. That's how it felt. We carried on talking about our lives. We carried on talking about how the Dharma is affecting us personally, intimately. We managed to get what we needed, but we also interacted with people in the world. We just, even if it was just asking for directions, there were connections made. But I was very, very aware, you know, part of me was quite excited because there was a possibility of coffee and cake. We had 20 minutes to spare. Anyway, well, you know, there was coffee and cake. But of course, it's over, isn't it? The lovely French pastries baked by a man called Pascal, who has lived in Ledbury for 35 years. Wonderful, wonderful little interaction with Pascal. But it's over, and then that's it. That's it. That's what, for me, Ledbury had to offer. We'll all be going back into that bigger world all too soon. And whatever hankerings we've had while we're on retreat, I'm just sort of here to say, you know, really stay here, because the world doesn't have that much to offer. It's the world that needs us, really, not us needing what the world has to offer. That's how it is. Perhaps we have to keep discovering that for ourselves. Perhaps I have to keep rediscovering that. But it is the truth. And of course, the world out there isn't always as charming as Ledbury is. Just the madness that we seem to be living in as a society, as a culture, as a world, it feels to me increasingly mad. You know, and the awful things that are happening. Just you know, all around us, the conflicts, the madness, the Paris atrocities were awful, and in a way, just sort of horrible to think about. And at the same time, they feel like they're of a piece. If they were just stand alone, they'd be awful enough. But it feels like there are underlying trends going on, and we are not in control of what's happening. We think that we're living in a comfortable, safe, liberal, democratic, Western civilized world. That civilization is paper thin. It's paper thin, and we're not in control. You know, in Paris, there's also the climate talks, and for all the good words and the perhaps even good intentions, we're not in control. We're not really in control, and it's not safe. I was talking to a friend who's a politician about our government's decision to bomb ISIS in Syria. And she was saying how difficult a decision it is to make, but that the government, David Cameron, has pledged £1 billion to help regenerate Syria after whatever's left. And kind of want to, it makes you want to weep at times, doesn't it? The madness of this. I don't know much about politics. I don't know much about Syria. What I do know is that somehow we've contributed to this mess. There is this dictator, Assad. There was this revolutionary force against him, wasn't there, that we supported, that the Americans supported, and then you get splinter groups. The Kurds have their own agenda, understandable perhaps, but they have their own cause. ISIS is a splinter group of a revolutionary group that we supported, and now we're bombing them, And originally Assad was the enemy, and Assad's still in power. And what are we doing? What do we hope to achieve? Now, I'm not saying that Buddhism has the answer. I'm not saying it does. That would be naive and silly. I do think we need intelligent political and social approaches to try and find our way through what feels like a tangle of hatred and violence and fear. We do need intelligent political solutions, and I don't know what they are. I can't help but feel, though, that dropping bombs on ISIS isn't part of that intelligent approach that we need. That's what, I mean, I could be wrong, of course, but who knows? But that's my gut instinct. What I do know is that if we're going to have long-term solutions to the issues that the world faces, that our culture faces, we need to address some underlying issues. It's not going to just carry on the way it's going without us being able to address some underlying issues. And what I think Buddhism can offer is some sort of perspective on those underlying issues. I believe that we've got a crisis of values in our culture, a real, real crisis of values. In a way, we've got a vacuum of values. And what fills that vacuum is the lowest common denominator of human greed. It's that fills the vacuum and creates a world where we are reduced to consumers, to shop. That seems to be a message that our culture is keeps on reinforcing. Buy more and you'll be happy. Buy more and all your problems will be solved. Buddhism says that mind creates world. Singha Manis yesterday talked about the teaching of Pratichasamapada and emphasized that Buddhism is very clear that matter isn't the primary reality. Inert matter is not the primary reality. In a way, Buddhism is hesitant to talk about fundamental realities. But if we had to, it would say that it would be better, more true, to say that mind is more a primary reality, and that what we think of as matter is a manifestation of the energy of mind. That everything is a manifestation of consciousness. If that's true, and I believe it is, mind literally creates world. Our intentions, our values, our behaviours, our minds, individually and collectively, have created the world. Singha Manis went into the nature of perception and how experience is created by the mind. Any experience. We don't really know what's outside of experience, because anything that you can experience, that I can experience, is mediated through the senses, through the mind. We don't even know, or Buddhism is agnostic about whether there's an objective reality beyond our experience. Is there an objective world beyond our experience? Buddhism says, possibly. If there is, we'll never know it, because everything that we experience is through our senses and through the mind. And if we had different senses, we would experience differently. How we experience the world isn't how it is. It can't be. It's dependent on our senses. A fly would experience the world very differently. A bat would experience it very differently. Where it's more pertinent is that if we had a different consciousness, we would experience the world differently. We would behave differently. And on this retreat, that's what we've been doing. We've been trying to develop a different consciousness, each of us, and collectively we've been supporting each other in that, to develop a better mind, a fitter mind, as Maitreya Bandi calls it, a better mind. And when we do that, you see how we create a world. We turn this retreat centre, which is already very lovely, into a realm of magic. And there has been magic at times on this retreat. If you've not experienced it yet, I really hope you do. It's precious. And what's more, as Singha Manas was saying last night, when we experience magic, it's pointing to truth. It's not just that we've suddenly had too much coffee and we're you know, on some sort of buzz. It's not that. We're closer to the way things are. We're closer to the way things are. Compare this to how we normally live. This is closer to the way things are. How we normally live is deluded. And most of the world is living in a delusion, most of the time. Our Western liberal democracy, as I said, it's fragile, it's paper thin. That's not to knock it completely. I mean, it's a huge achievement, isn't it, of civilization, to be able to have the sort of society that we've got, where there's greater freedom than perhaps any society has ever enjoyed. Greater freedom, greater leisure, greater comfort, greater life expectancy than probably we've ever, human beings, have enjoyed. The Buddha was said to be a prince in luxury, living in luxury, in palaces, three palaces. His father had given him everything. But probably each of us live in greater luxury than an Indian prince 2,500 years ago would have dreamt of. And for the Buddha, he saw through the delusion of that luxury, that we tend to be more seduced. Every time we turn on the phone, we're being seduced by technology, by consumerism. But yes, it's great that we've got this democracy, but we have to ask, don't we, what's it for? What is it for? Why have we got this freedom? I mean, what are we going to do with it? That's what I mean. What are we going to do with this freedom, this luxury that we have, this comfort that we enjoy? What is it for? In after the horrible things in Paris, I was reading about somebody who had tweeted, one of the survivors had tweeted. I mean, there was a lot of courage and bravery shown, wasn't there? There was heroism amongst some of the people who died. It was very, very moving. Or even amongst some of the survivors. I saw a thing about a man who went outside into an area where there was shootings happening and grabbed two women who were in the line of fire and dragged them into the basement of his restaurant and kept them safe along with himself. That takes huge courage. I don't know whether I would have the courage to do that. There's some enormous acts of heroism that seem to come from ordinary human beings in extraordinary conditions. But there was somebody on social media tweeted afterwards that, you know, they were going to carry on heroically drinking in their cafes and eating in their restaurants, that Paris cafe culture would not be defeated by terrorism. And yes, I kind of salute that, and I think, oh, is it cafe culture that we're trying to defend? And I love cafe culture. Don't get me wrong. I'm going to, with Maitreya Bandi, we're going to do a sponsored three cafes challenge in a couple of months' time. Sort of a la Three Peaks challenge. But we're going to go to three cafes in one afternoon and I'd like us to raise £3,000 for Vajrasana. Anyway, that's just a little plug for our Three Cafes Challenge. There's a lot of publicity to come, so you'll hear more about it. But there surely has to be more that we're living for, doesn't there? There has to be more as a world. One of the effects of the culture we've created is a rampant cult of self. Sometimes people come to Sri Ratna and wonder if Buddhism's a cult or Sri Ratna's a cult, sort of oblivious to the fact that we live everywhere in this rampant cult of self, of me and mine. And we think that that's normal, but actually it's relatively new. I'm only 50, and I can remember a time when it wasn't so prevalent, this huge expectation that I can have everything in my life, everything that I want, and if I don't get it, I've been hard done by, and somebody's going to pay. There's this rampant kind of sense that we're owed everything. I mean, the career, the perfect partner, the glorious children, if we want children, the house, the car, oh, and a really dynamic spiritual life that makes us very interesting. That's what we're being promised. That's what we're being sold. I do think there's... I mean, I'm not saying that that's all that we've got. People do experience love, for example. Singha Manas was talking about falling in love. And for many, many people, that can be like a peak experience. For all of us, probably, it's a peak experience. Hopefully, for Dharma practitioners, it's not the height of your peak experiences. Hopefully. So there can be, but this heightened sense of reality of falling in love. What Singha Manas didn't talk about yesterday, partly because he's young, is that it doesn't last. Is that it doesn't last. Cover your ears, Singha Manas. I didn't mean to. It doesn't last, and yet we put so much store on this romantic myth, don't we, that we're going to find lasting happiness with that one other perfect person. And it causes so much pain when either we don't find that perfect person, or we do find them and they turn out not to be so perfect after a while. Yeah. It's a myth that we're living. But a myth not in a healthy sense, not in the way that Buddhism talks about myth. It's a delusion. It's a fantasy that we're being sold that perfect, lasting happiness can be achieved by that one other special person. That's all that we need in our lives. That's all that we need. We need much, much more. I'm not saying that romantic love is bad or wrong or not beautiful. It's got some, you know, wonderful aspects to it. When somebody falls in love, you just want to sort of really sort of wish them well. There's such kind of... There is a beauty to it, particularly if you're young. But have you seen the film 45 Years? It was one of the best films of this year. I really do recommend it. Go and watch it if you find yourself smitten. or even if you don't, go and watch it. It's Charlotte Rampling and Tom Courtney play this couple who are about to celebrate their 45th wedding anniversary. They're in their late middle age. He's a bit older. Late middle age, but they're a really decent middle-class couple who are kind to each other, sort of well-meaning, probably like millions of people all over, living in Norfolk, living a kind of decent country, middle-class life, retired couple. And it's days, the film begins just a few days, maybe a week, before the 45th wedding anniversary, at which there's going to be a big party. And it begins with them, well, him, receiving a letter from, well, containing some information about an ex-girlfriend before he met Kate, who is Charlotte Rampling's character. And this information, this letter, which at first seems innocuous, it's some information from the past, a sort of voice from the past. You just watch how over the days leading up to their 45th wedding anniversary, it unravels their whole marriage. Everything falls apart. But it does so in the most subtle ways. One critic said that in this film, nothing happens and everything happens. And it is like that. Everything falls apart. And particularly Kate realises that she's been living a fantasy, a lie, for 45 years of her life. And it's tragic, but it's also so, so devastating because it's so ordinary. It's that sort of ordinary, everyday tragedy that we buy into when we pretend to ourselves that all we have to do is look after number one, and then number one needs to find the perfect partner, and then number one and number two, individualism, ardour, will make the world beautiful. Yeah. The values behind this retreat, there's been, well, we've talked about awareness, haven't we? We've talked about kindness, we've talked about courage, we've talked about energy, we've talked about receptivity. We've also talked about community. But perhaps community is perhaps the most radical experience of being on retreat. Living with 120 people, most of whom are probably strangers to each other, and in just a few days creating this sort of harmony, that is something incredible. That is so much, much, much more than our contemporary culture offers us. Yeah, so much more. It's a richness that we would be very, very stupid to ignore once we've tasted it. That would be another tragedy. I'll come back to that later. And vegetarianism. We've enjoyed such delicious food. Probably most people here aren't used to being vegetarian. Think about that. Think about that next time you do the Metta-Bhavana. And think about when we want to do something constructive for the environment, think about vegetarianism. It's the law of karma that's been in process here on this retreat. That's what we've been, whether we knew that or not, that's what we've been making use of. The law of karma is what we've been making use of. When we meditate, when we generate more skillful states of mind, awareness, kindness, empathy, receptivity, a sense of reverence. When we generate those skillful states of mind, we not only transform our own minds, we have an effect on the world around us, each other around us, and then sometimes something more magical happens between us. That is the law of karma. And it's the law of karma, maybe we wouldn't call it that, but I think everybody needs to learn. This is what we don't teach in schools. This is the root of happiness. This is the root of happiness. And we should really be teaching it to every person possible. Never mind calling it karma. Never mind calling it Buddhism. It's human. And it's real and it's true. And we need to really take note of it. Really take note of it. But I want to say something more. So I've said so far that Buddhism's not enough on its own. We do need political and social structures, and Buddhism's not going to necessarily just create those for us. So we do need intelligent leaders to, intelligent politicians to be creating solutions for us. I'm not that optimistic about what the people that we've got, unfortunately. But there you go, we do need that. But then I'm saying that political and social solutions themselves are never going to be enough. They're never going to be enough without addressing values. Yeah? Without addressing fundamental human values. And those values are mind-made. And unless we're willing to work on our minds, there's no real solution. There's no real solution. To work on our minds, we need to be prepared to work individually. And to do that, we will probably, in fact, almost definitely, need the support of others. On our own, we wouldn't have been able to do what we've done over the last few days. None of us could. The 19 of us on the team couldn't have done this. And none of us individually could have done this. We will need other people to support us. And this is what the Sangha exists for. You could say this is what the Sangha is. It's there to provide supportive conditions for each of us to work on our minds according to the law of karma. And then collectively, as a Sangha, we contribute something more to the world. And I'll come on to that. But I don't think that's enough. The law of karma alone isn't enough. Wonderful though it is to create a thoroughly human, healthy world, it's not enough. At least that's what the Buddha taught. The reason it's not enough is that no matter how healthy and happy and kind and aware we are, there is still the existential truth of loss and death and sickness to confront. The existential situation is still with us, whether we are enjoying ourselves in cafes or on retreat or wherever, or whether we're in Syria being bombed on, or refugees who are trying to flee to safer places. The existential situation is the same. Yeah, it's the human condition. And so it's not enough just to create a happy, healthy world. At least it wouldn't be enough for me. The difficulty is that it's already would be such an achievement to do that, that sometimes it's hard to look beyond that. It's sometimes hard to look beyond that. But there is a danger that if we don't look beyond that, we'll settle for lower ideals. And our ideals need to be, I think they need to be infinite. For human beings to realize their potential, the ideal needs to be limitless. The ideals need to be limitless. If we settle for lower ideals, we'll end up in a comfortable middle-class country, living middle-class, comfortable lives, and yes, we'll be perhaps nice to each other, but we're all still in the same existential boat. The trouble that I sometimes think Western Buddhism is facing, and Sangharakshita talks about this, is that most of us approach Buddhism because we just want to be a bit happier. We want to be a bit happier. And sort of fair enough. Fair enough. There's nothing kind of wrong with wanting to be happy. But if that is the sole aim of our lives, to be individually, personally, a little happier, where sooner or later we're going to lose that game. We will lose. Yeah, And at some point we'll have to face up to the truths, the real existential truths. Subhuti, who's my preceptor and teacher, was talking about the danger is that we reduce the Dharma to our own level, our own ambitions, and we turn it into an adjustment therapy to make this life more comfortable. And actually, that wasn't the Buddha's message. The Buddha had a very, very comfortable life before he was the Buddha. He had a very, very comfortable life before he embarked on his spiritual quest. His message is much, much more radical and profound and difficult. It's that this life, samsaric existence, conditioned existence, will not work ever. Yeah? It might bring you some relief. It has its joys. Sure, it's not all pain. And we should do what we can to make it a better world. And yet, that isn't the ultimate answer, because samsara doesn't stop. Yeah? Conditioned existence doesn't stop. Dukkha doesn't stop. For me, I didn't come to Buddhism because I wanted to be happier. I came to Buddhism because I wanted answers to life's problems, particularly the problem of death. When I was 11, my dad died quite suddenly, one night, of a heart attack. I watched him die. Actually, I didn't. He died in an ambulance, but I watched him in pain, writhing in pain, on his bed, saying how... Well, he was trying to express regrets about how he hadn't lived the life that he should have done. In particular, he hadn't been kind enough. And I can remember him holding my hand as he was saying this, in agony, through bursts of pain. That had an impact on me that changed the course of my life. I couldn't just then get back to believing that life was about growing up, having a family, a mortgage, a car, which we'd just got. That surely wasn't it. I also was fortunate enough to have some, for want of a better word, psychic communication with him, a connection with him after his death. And that convinced me that life wasn't just about being stoical and saying, oh, well, we must make the best of it, that death wasn't the end. There was something magical and mysterious going on after death. Death wasn't the end, and therefore I didn't know what life was. And I looked for answers. I needed an answer. I didn't really even know what the question was, but I guess in retrospect I needed an answer to death, to both to personal loss, but also the universal truth of death, that the answers have to be both personal and universal. Do you see what I mean? They're not just abstract, they have to apply to our lives, but to be real truths, they have to also be universal. So yes, for me, there was actually, although my dad's death was devastating, it was also the start of an adventure for me, of questing, of looking for answers. I used to think I was a wizard, and I had this thing that, well, basically I was going to be a wizard. Later on, it was a Zen master. I was going to be a Zen master. And I always imagined myself with a Zen stick hitting people. And it's come close at times. As chair of the London Buddhist Centre, it's very tempting at times. So it was this quest, and as a teenager, I thought of myself as a Buddhist. I didn't know much about Buddhism, but I'd read a little bit, and I thought of myself as a Buddhist. And at 19, I found a Buddhist group, a Zen Buddhist group, and I decided that was it. I was a Buddhist. I was a Zen Buddhist. I was studying physics, also looking for answers in science. I would have arguments with one of my housemates, Tim, about Western philosophy. At that age, that precocious kind of young age, I thought I knew all the answers, and they were Buddhist, coupled with some physics. And I would tell Tim not to waste his time on reading Hume or whatever he was reading, because Western philosophy was just barking up the wrong tree. He needed to meditate. But I wasn't meditating. I was all mouth. It was mouth Zen. Because the Zen group hadn't taught me to meditate. They they just taught about mindfulness. And I didn't know what mindfulness was. And mindfulness, as I understood it, meant going to bed at the same time every day and getting up at the same time every morning. And that's what I tried to do. And I can't do that now. And as a 19-year-old, I couldn't do it then. So I gave up on Buddhism. I kind of thought, oh, Buddhism might be true, but I can't do this. I'm not going to ever get up, you know, every day at 7 in the morning. So Buddhism's beyond me. I didn't mean to say all that, actually. That just... what I was trying to get to was that Buddhism is pointing to a deeper truth, a deeper reality that Singha Manas was talking about. Singha Manas was talking about Pratichasamapada, conditioned co-production, this law that everything arises in dependence upon conditions, that there are no things. Everything is constructed. And those constructs are partly, at least, mind-made. And they all are contingent on other conditions, and then they go on to create other conditions. There's just this flowing, constructed reality, this realm that we're living in. And it's dreamlike. It's dreamlike. Subhadramati said this. The Buddha, we still refer to him as waking up. It's as if we're dreaming. And in a dream, we live in a constructed reality, don't we? We feel like we're having a real experience, but actually it's mind-made. Everything in a dream is mind-made. And there's an analogy there for this so-called reality, apart from it's a collective dream. Now, we don't know that because we haven't woken up. It's all that we know. But what Buddhism says is that we can wake up. We can wake up to a deeper reality. And when we wake up to that deeper reality, or even when we glimpse it, we immediately realize that this ordinary consciousness and the world that we take for so as being so real and solid is not what it appears to be. And not only material objects, but also other people. Singha Manas was talking about space and time itself, and most pertinently, me. I mean you as well as me. I mean this sense of self is a construct. Everything that I think of as me, look at what you think of as you, everything that you can think about as you is a construct. What I mean by that is it's not permanent, it's not solid, it's contingent. It's a construct and it's mind-made. When we see through this, we reach, as it were, beyond conditioned reality. We go beyond this conditioned realm. When we see through this, there's something new, completely unpredictable, unanticipatable, that arises. Were that not the case, the Buddha said he wouldn't have taught about conditioned reality. It would have been cruel to point out that everything that we know of as the world is just a delusion, is just mind-made. Were it not true that there was something more beyond this conditioned reality, and were it not true that what is more is ultimately fulfilling, it's all the fulfillment that we yearn for, the bliss, the freedom, the fearlessness, the energy that we yearn for, the creativity and the love that we yearn for, is there in this deeper dimension of reality. And then what's more wonderful is that this deeper dimension of reality isn't some heavenly world that's sort of, you know, that you only get to after you die. It's the true nature of this conditioned reality. If we could really see this conditioned reality as it is, it would be everything that we yearn for, and it would be beautiful. There would be magic all the time. Singha Manas and Subhadramati have been trying to point to this today, the magic of breathing. Well, that is in everything. There is only magic all the time. There is only beauty all the time. And if we could experience that, there would be only love in our experience all the time. There would be this natural outpouring of metta, spontaneous outpouring of metta all the time. And the world would be transformed, at least for us. But again, that's perhaps not enough. Because the Buddha achieved that under the Bodhi tree. He achieved that. He realized that. He saw that. Had he just sat under the Bodhi tree then and not communicated the Dharma, well, we wouldn't be here. And that magic would have, as it were, faded with the death of his body. But he didn't. He communicated it. He communicated it. And in communicating it, he created Sangha. First with those five friends, and then, well, through more and more people, there's a living Sangha, a tradition of this magic that has survived for 2,500 years and reaches us here today. That thread of magic is continuing. It was discovered by the Buddha. It is there in reality all the time. And in the form of Buddhism, it reaches us today to see if we can transform our lives. What that means is that it isn't just an individual affair. It becomes a collective endeavour. And it's only actually when it becomes a collective endeavour does it reach its true fulfilment. Yeah? Only when it's a collective endeavour. Because it's not enough to have an enlightened being. We need an enlightened world. And that is what the Sangha is trying to become. It's trying to become an enlightened world. Now that is a quixotic venture. It's an ideal that is impossible. And yet it is the only thing worth striving for. Without that, without impossible ideals, we've got middle class lives in cafe culture. That's what we've got. And that's not going to be the answer. No wonder you've got religious fanatics and fundamentalists who want to smash the Western democracy that we've got. Because from a particular perspective, it's hollow. Do you see? It's hollow. And so if you had religious faith, and if that faith was also fanatical, you might want to smash what we've got because you think there has to be something more, like community, like value, like a truth beyond this life only. It's just that those fundamentalists and fanatics have also got it very wrong. And I think that Buddhism has something to offer both those perspectives. It has a sanity and an idealism based in reality itself. And without that, we're not going to be able to transform the world. We're never going to be able to do it. With it, I think we've got an adventure ahead of us. And people need adventures. My life has turned into an adventure since I found the Dharma. I'm really, really struck that I haven't seen Star Wars, but I'm told it's the biggest grossing film of all time. And once all the merchandise has been sold, it's billions of pounds are going to be spent going to the cinema to watch this one film and to buy your little Jedi knights or lightsabers or whatever. Billions of pounds are going to be spent on entertaining ourselves. Actually, I want to see it too. on entertaining ourselves, because we all yearn for some ideal. Why is it? It's not just the kids. Why is it that that appeals? There's heroism. There's community. There's adventure. There's a battling of the forces of hatred and power with the forces of truth and goodness. There's an ideal that people yearn for. We still yearn for it, but what we've done is say, oh, I know, I'll go to the cinema and fulfill this little yearning for a while, you know, sort of stimulate, titillate that little yearning, and then I'll go back to my ordinary lives or ordinary life. When the Buddha decided to teach, what was happening was something even more incomprehensible than his enlightenment experience. He transcended this conditioned world under that tree, under the Bodhi tree, and then when he decided to teach, it was as if he returned back to this conditioned world with bliss-bestowing hands, with compassion overflowing in his heart. He returned back to wake others up, to teach the Dharma. So it's not about escapism. Buddhism says sometimes people mistake Buddhism for escapism. It's not about that. It's not actually even about going on retreat. It's about learning to transform our minds, to see through the delusive, dreamlike nature of this world, so that we can go back to it with the love that then is spontaneous, so that we can help others, so that we can alleviate suffering, so that we can become a force for good. That feels to me much more magical and ideal than any Disney film or is ever going to be able to imagine. And in a way, this force for good in the world is what Sangha is. That's what Sangha at least is trying to be. That's what the Triratna Buddhist order is trying to be. I want to just start finishing by saying, if you've experienced anything of that magic on this retreat, and I know many, many of you have, you might not even know that you have, actually. Sometimes it's not obvious until you leave, until you encounter Ledbury, and then you realise what a magical state you were in. if you've experienced something of that, don't just treat it as another trip to the cinema, yeah? Albeit a longer one. It's so easy to think, that was a nice experience, now I'll get on with my life, my real life. It's so easy to do that. In fact, it's almost inevitable that we'll forget to some degree the magic of our experience here. But what we can do is commit ourselves to reorienting our lives as much as we can. We can't do that all in one go. It's not possible to just leave our careers or, I don't know, go live in a Buddhist center or do all of that. It's not possible for all of us to just do that. It wasn't even possible for me to do that all in one go. But there's always a next step. There's always a next step. For each one of us, there is a next step in that reorientation. And think about what that next step is. Tomorrow, you've got a day of silence to think about how you want to move forward in your life. And do that from a place of magic. Do that while you're still in touch with something incredible and true. And then follow through. Really follow through. And then keep taking the next step. There's another next step and another next step. And don't settle for anything less than full realization. There's nothing more important in our lives than this quest for waking up to the truth. I believe very strongly, and I wish I could share the conviction with you as fully as I feel it, that that is what human life is. I mean, that's what it's for. That's what it's for. It's to wake up to our highest human potential and to help others to do the same, collectively be a force for good in the world so that we can transform this suffering world into a pure land, into a Buddha land. That's what human life is for. And of course we'll not achieve it, but any movement in that direction in this lifetime is worthwhile, is worthwhile. I feel really, really fortunate. If I were to die now, and I'm older than my father was when he died, I feel really blessed that I won't have the regrets that he had on his deathbed. I hope that I'll be able to, however long I do have, I hope I'll be able to carry on living this adventure and not settle. I'm partly talking to me, and I'm partly talking to all of us who are already committed, who are already ordained, because frankly it gets harder. It gets more tempting to settle down into even a comfortable Buddhist life. I hope that none of us here will ever settle in that comfortable Buddhist life. I've got one more point to make, but I just want to read you something that Einstein wrote in Old Age. He said, "I have never belonged wholeheartedly to a country, a state, nor to a circle of friends, nor even to my own family. When I was still a rather precocious young man, I already realized most vividly the futility of the hopes and aspirations that most people pursue throughout their lives. Well-being and happiness never appeared to me as an absolute aim. I am even inclined to compare such moral aims to the ambitions of a pig." He didn't mince his words, did he? We've got a human life, and human beings have a potential to be much, much more. We've been talking on this retreat about the three jewels, and I just want to finish with that. I've been trying to, in this talk, give you some indication of the importance of the Sangha jewel, what value it has individually and for the world. The Sangha jewel perhaps is the most difficult jewel to bring into being. But in a way, the Sangha jewel isn't separate from the other two jewels. The Sangha doesn't exist without the Dharma. Otherwise, without the Dharma, it's just a happy collective group. And the Dharma doesn't exist in a way without the Buddha teaching it. And as a reality principle, it needs manifesting in human form. So the Dharma doesn't, in a way, manifest without the Buddha. And the Buddha, well, we wouldn't have even known about him had he not chosen to teach, without the Sangha. The three jewels are not separate. They're like three faces of a jewel, a single jewel. They're three aspects of what makes this ideal a transpersonal, a superhuman ideal. And as you practice, they become more mysterious. A teacher of mine once said that when he was new to Buddhism, he didn't know what the three jewels were. And then he learned about the three jewels and he knew what they were. And as he's seen more clearly the truth of the Dharma, he doesn't know what they are at all, because they're beyond all conceptual grasp. And I hope that on this retreat you've had a glimpse of not just the theory, but of the truth of that, that there is a real value, a real reality beyond our ken, and it's the only thing worth living for. Thank you.